Beatty and I decided when we were going to get together, we're going to do something totally different. All of these other law firms, they have a department. I have a domestic relations, and I have a little energy group, and I have this. And we said, nope, we're going to do it for an industry.
And I said this to everyone who joined the firm. I said, you are joining an industry, and it's not the legal profession. You're joining the energy industry. You need to believe that you are part of the energy industry.
They took our offices and made one little office that we share, which is really disappointing because it's got all of Beatty's memorabilia in it.
Character matters. And people all of a sudden want to bring us back to the America of old, but they leave out the one thing that really does reflect the America of old, and that is the importance of character.
Yeah, Mike would always tell me, you have to, when someone was having a problem, oh, just tell them they're good and give them some love. I'd say, give me a break.
I apologize for remote Mike. He meant to say, my 20 best friends are my partner and my clients.
Welcome to a special edition of ProCo 360. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. ProCo 360's mission is to shine a light on the notable entrepreneurs and leaders who shape Colorado's business landscape. And today, we're celebrating the extraordinary lives and 30-year careers of two of our state's most influential figures, Michael Beatty and Michael Wozniak, co-founders of the Beatty & Wozniak Law Firm. From arguing landmark cases before the U.S. Supreme Court to founding a boutique firm that became a national powerhouse, these two men have defined what it means to lead with expertise and integrity. Today, we're stepping inside their partnership to explore the stories, the shared passion, and the bond that built a legacy. Join us as we go all in on the careers and friendship of Beatty and Wozniak. Michael, actually, you guys go by Mike. Welcome.
We do. Thanks so much, Dave.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it.
Listeners, Mike Wozniak is in Scottsdale right now, so he's remote on Zoom. And if I refer to you, Mike, as remote Mike, well, listeners, you'll understand that. But guys, start with the origin story of Beatty and Wozniak.
Mike, since you called me, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I will back up a little bit back to even just before the origin. I can tell you all that I was involved in the early 90s, late 80s, we were doing a deposition of a guy named Jack Greinberg. And Greinberg had sued a lot of my clients, and it turned out a lot of Mike Beatty's clients. And the way I first met Mike was he walked into the room, and we were deposing Mr. Greinberg, and Mr. Greinberg said that he was getting physically ill. And I said, why are you getting physically ill? And he said, every time Mike Beatty walks into the room, I get sick. And so that's how I first met Mr. Beatty.
And you decided that was partner material right there.
Actually,
right there, I did, yeah.
Actually, my response to that was, that's the greatest compliment I've ever received as an attorney in my life, which Jack didn't like.
Yeah.
No.
So then,
a few years later, honestly, Dave, what had happened was I was representing a lot of producers and oil and gas producers, and they had a gathering agreements with a company called CIG out of Colorado Springs. And I was working with some of the more junior lawyers like Becky Naker, and everything we would do, I would hear had to be run by some guy named Beatty. And I kept thinking, who is this mysterious man behind the screen? And it turned out that that it was Mr. Beatty, so that I was doing a lot of work. We were on other sides of the deals because I represented producers. He represented the pipeline companies. That's how we first met.
Yep. Now, I mean, back then, 30 years ago, the laws, the regs around oil and gas, I mean, it wasn't anything like it is now. I mean, was practicing law for the energy sector basically easy back then?
No, it was actually terrible back then because natural gas prices were regulated at the interstate level. They were deregulated at the intrastate level. There was confusion all the time. There was really chaos. And then all of a sudden, during the deregulation phase of natural gas, what happened is that there was litigation constantly between producers and pipelines as they were trying just to stave off bankruptcy.
Yeah. So how did you two come together and make the firm?
The most important thing to say is that we have both very close mutual friends. We had never met each other, but we had individual friends who were very close to both of us. And over the years, I had heard, you really need to meet Mike Wozniak. Mike had heard, you really need to meet Mike Beatty. You know, and what happened is that I ended up getting a phone call from Mike asking if I would be interested in joining his firm. And I said that I would reveal everything, but only on one condition. And at the time, I realized his incredible reputation. I knew what it would be like to be able to get him to come over and join me. So I said, look, I'm going to open my books. I'll be open kimono, but you've got to make a promise to me. And that is, if it's better for you to join my firm, you've got to join me. If it's better for me to join your firm, I will make a commitment right now that I will join your firm. And that's the way we turned
it. And which way did it go?
Well, it's Beatty and Wozniak. That answers the question.
Yeah, unfortunately, he wowed me. And I was the managing partner of a firm called Dorsey & Whitney, which is a very large national firm. And I was heading their Denver office. I had a great job. But at that time in my life, it was a little bit of a easier job. And I had opportunities like Mike did to get on various boards of directors. We had opportunities with clients to join them and invest with them. We also had, I was trying to get into a political realm. And these were all things that a national law firm didn't appreciate. Mm-hmm. They created conflicts in their eyes. They were also regulating our rates. And I knew that that Mike Beatty was the absolute best pipeline lawyer that I had ever heard of. And I was a decent producer lawyer. And we decided, you know, it would be amazing if we could bridge the gap, because normally we sued each other. But we said, well, is there a way that we might be able to take both sides of that industry and combine it?
Yeah. So where did this whole backing up, where did the interest for oil and gas come from?
Well,
Mike, you go first.
Mine is a little unusual because I went to Houston. I practiced at one of the big firms, Vince and Elkins, but I said, I'm not doing energy work. I want to be a trial lawyer. I'm not going to do energy work. I ended up becoming a law professor at the University of Idaho. My wife ends up with a PhD from Washington State and ends up getting a job at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs. I promise that I will go to help her career. I moved to Colorado Springs. I have no way of getting a job in that town. Just on a sabbatical was what I was doing. Hmm. And I was offered a job at Colorado Interstate Gas Company. I took the job and it changed my life. I mean, from that point on, I ended up being an energy lawyer and loved it. I loved the industry, and I loved the opportunity to practice in it.
Hmm. Mike Wozniak, how'd you develop this
interest? Yeah, mine was a little different. My last year of undergrad school, I actually took a class in environmental law, and it really wasn't law. It was just the new environmental movement was just coming up in the mid-70s. And I really enjoyed it. And they kept using hypotheticals the whole time about how this energy industry was doing the terrible things. And I kept thinking to myself, there's got to be two sides of that story. And so when I graduated from the University of Colorado Law School, I had the opportunity to go work with a real estate slash oil and gas firm. And I started off doing real estate and gradually got into the regulatory side of oil and gas commission work. And I didn't start that till 82. But so I probably did 500 oil and gas commission hearings over the years on the producer side. And so that really became my focus before I met Mike.
Well, you know, it seems that a lot of law firms will have an energy department. You guys chose to focus exclusively on energy, on oil and gas. I mean, you know, what's that? It sounds like that's worked out. But when other people say, oh, our firm does that, or this firm does that, What do you say?
Well, actually, that was a very conscious decision. Yeah. That was something that I was totally committed to. And that was, and I said this to everyone who joined the firm, I said, you are joining an industry, and it's not the legal profession. You're joining the energy industry. You are a part, and you need to believe that you are part of the energy industry. You still have to have the skills of a lawyer, but the key to success and the key to getting trust from your client is to be able to tell them, to never ask that question. Now, what do you mean by an MCF or an MMBTU? What is it? How does a gas process?
Well, and don't they also have to know that you're on their side?
Oh.
I mean, the energy industry is constantly badgered
right.
by people, sometimes rightly, sometimes with misunderstandings. But don't you need to align philosophically at a deep level with your clients in this space?
That's really a fun question. Another one of my comments is there's never a great general counsel of an energy company who's not a Democrat. There's never a great president of a company who's not a Republican, because you need to be able to understand the process in order to be an effective general counsel. You got to be an entrepreneur, a real believer in the energy industry if you're going to be the president. And so that it does work. I was a very strong, I was Roy Romer's chief of staff at one point and then chairman of the Democratic Party. I was a big Democrat, but I truly believed then, I believe now, that natural gas is a much better alternative than coal and can really make a big difference in terms of moving us to wind and solar.
Yeah, Wozniak, you've been nodding and just waiting to get in. What's your take?
Well, here's the funniest thing, which is a really cute story. But, you know, I had this great job as this managing partner of this other law firm. And we decided, Beatty and I decided when we were going to get together, we're going to do something totally different. Because as you said, Dave, all of these other law firms, they have a department. I have a domestic relations and I have a little energy group and I have this. So we said, nope, we're going to do it but for an industry. And I remember directly, right when we made the announcement, I was walking down the 16th Street Mall and I bumped into two of my old friends that I'd practiced with against at Holm, Roberts, and Owen. And they both said, Mike, you're making a big mistake. You can't put all your eggs in an industry basket. You guys are going to go out of business in 3 years. Well, obviously, there is no more Holm, Roberts, and Owen, there's still a Beatty Wozniak. So,
but I mean, if
it
you're,
took a long time.
Yes, now if you're tied to an industry, everybody knows about the 80s when there was that huge, oil dip and all that. Like, did your business almost go away when the oil companies were in hard times?
No, not at all. In fact, we were busier than ever because they were involved in litigation. I'm a trial lawyer, and so I was constantly busy. I had people lined up outside the door in order to try to get us to take care of the case. And again, the reason that they wanted to do that is that I never said to anyone, I am a litigator, and it makes no difference whether it's a patent case or whether it's an automobile accident or domestic relations. I said, I know one industry, and I can take care of you on that. I know the regs. I know the rules. And it makes all the difference in the world.
You know, I got to believe it does, because in my experience, meeting a lot of executives from the industry, they feel picked on a lot. And to have someone in their corner that's a believer— or at least, is on their side, has to be a huge advantage.
It is, and you see it now in the tech industry, which is that litigators are saying, we are solely involved in the tech industry, and that's all we do. So this idea of specialization is incredibly important, especially as the rules of the laws and everything become more and more complex.
Yep.
Society becomes more complex.
When litigation, everybody was getting along and wasn't busy, I had a title group. And when things started getting busier again, the regulatory area, and in Colorado, we continually were doing new rules and regulations.
Oh, my gosh,
so
yes.
We had a group do that. So there was always some part of the industry that was very active.
So, Mike Wozniak, I'll ask you both. I mean, let's face it, the energy sector has gone through cycles of popularity, we'll call it that, right? People ever take you off to the corner at parties and thrash you or ask you, are they more curious or are they more, do they have some sort of a judgment around the world in which you work?
Absolutely.
Always.
Always.
Yeah.
Good or bad, right?
I mean, Oh, gosh. I mean, it was great. And Mike, I certainly will attest to this, too. But we had some great friends that I'd always get invited to in Boulder. And you'd have a party. And as soon as people would say, well, what do you do? You know, and at first, you know, you try to say to yourself, do I say I'm a natural resource lawyer or do I say I work in the energy work? Because energy can be solar
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Everything. And or do you just come right out and say it and say, I'm an oil and gas lawyer? So I usually just, especially if I knew they would be really upset, I'd say, yep, I'm an oil and gas lawyer. And then we'd start the discussion. But, you know, Dave, if you really are honest about it, and I would be able to say, listen, one of my jobs is to ensure that all the oil and gas companies do comply with the environmental regs and do comply with all of the Colorado regs that are in place. People will sort of soften up a little, and yeah. I would sort of portray it as saying, listen, we are the just like judges do, they interpret the law. We are the people that ensure that people follow the rules, and yeah. we can produce energy environmentally sensitively, and we can comply with all of the regs that are necessary to make sure that you have the energy.
Yep.
But the last thing I'll say is right now, if people say what you do, they say, are you just like Landman, you know, the TV show?
Of course, not exactly. But hey, was there a moment when you guys realized that this whole focusing on a niche on the oil and gas industries was like, yeah, we were right? Like, was there a moment in time that you looked at each other and felt that way?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the simple answer to that question. I mean, when was that?
Yeah.
From early on, as soon as the biggest problem we had was what Mike pointed to earlier, which is people were saying, could you really succeed if you had a lawyer who was representing producers and another lawyer who was representing pipelines? Because there had been a history of litigation as a result of the deregulation. Once that deregulation was over, then all of a sudden people really realized that it was critical that they begin to work together, because if they, you know, division was easy to conquer them. And my point, and I tried to make this all the time, was to say, look, the history of the world, you may not like it, but the history of the world is the history of energy. What you see all the time is people who need energy. And if you have it, you succeed. If you don't have it, you're going to fail. And it's critical. So Mike is totally right, which is a big responsibility we had, was to make certain that people did it responsibly. And so it didn't bother us at all to go out and get the head of the EPA Region 8 and say, I want you to be in our law firm. And people would say, how could you do that? And you'd say, because it's critically important that we comply.
Is that what you found in your careers, that as you guided your clients to comply, that they would? Or was it, you know, I mean, we've all heard stories of like Landman. We're like, OSHA? What's OSHA? Like, that's for other kinds of companies that aren't so far away where people can't see them. Like, right? So talk about that.
Well, I will say this. The companies that we had the most fun working with and became dear friends with mm-hmm. were the ones that, yeah, Dave, there was always that, do I have to? And what I always felt best about was saying, yeah, we have no choice. We are going to do this right, and we're going to comply, and you're going to be successful. And as long as you could do that and look, and they'd look you in the eye, and the really small companies could say, I can't afford it. Some of the regulations were expensive. And we would try to find ways to make sure they were still in compliance. So the answer was, yeah, people did. And not necessarily grudgingly. The really good companies were happy to work with us to do it right.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's less expensive to do that, right? I mean, ultimately, even if they don't want to.
Well, not the one thing I guess I'd say, and this is just about the process itself, and that is, it's pretty easy to show somebody that if they don't, it's going to be a pretty miserable life for them. Mm-hmm. And we can point to examples all the time of people who have all of a sudden been dragged through litigation for years and years and years.
Did you guys ever disassociate from clients with whom you just couldn't align on how to run their company through your legal lens?
Sure. Yeah, there were a number of times Mike and I would just get together and say, and don't take this wrong, but we're going to fire these guys because we cannot. Our integrity was so important when I would appear before all of the oil and gas commissions all throughout the West. You would want to make sure that they knew when you stood up, you were telling the truth. And I think Mike had the same experience in front of judges. And there were a number of times when we just sat down and said, yep, it's time to disassociate. And we would. And that's the best thing you can do for your integrity.
I actually had a case where all of a sudden someone came in, they told me their set of facts. And what happened is on that basis, I began litigation in order to support them. During the course of the discovery, I found an email that all of a sudden showed that what they had told me was absolutely untrue. And what I did was I said, you know, I can withdraw, or what we can do is we can settle this and get this thing taken care of. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I guess, why don't you start the negotiation to settle it? And I said to him, why don't we start by you writing a check and I'll take it over. And I walked over and I said, the position that we took is not viable and not one that I'm willing to proceed upon. And here it is. And the person said, it means a lot. I've always heard a lot about Beatty and Wozniak. And what happens is that this confirms everything that I've heard.
Wow.
You just have to, Mike just said it. Your credibility is everything. You just never put it at risk.
Do you think, I mean, when you think about digging a little deeper into the whole aspect of integrity as you develop reputations as lawyers, I mean, your job, I guess I've always thought of attorneys as often like try to help the client get what they want. And where does that intersect with integrity and with your own reputations and things like that?
Well, I don't want to get maudlin here, but let me just tell you that there wouldn't be a Beatty and Wozniak if we didn't both feel that way and understood that both of us felt that way, that it was that important. I'll also tell you, and this think about this for a client agreement, which was very, very important in making our firm. We had one client where all of a sudden they said that they had acquired a client of mine, and they said, we've looked at the contract, and they have a retainer agreement with you, Mike, and we think that that's really an unreasonable contract, and I'd really like to get out of it. And I said, fine, I don't want anyone to be represented who doesn't want me to represent them. And they said, look, but I know that you've incurred some cost as a result of the agreement that was made. We'll give you 6 months and let you work through it, and then we'll terminate the contract. I said, fine, no problem. They called me a few months later, and they said, if this is working for you, I think that we'd like to continue on with the agreement. And I said, I wouldn't. Let me explain to you what I will do. And that is, we'll continue on at the rate that you said that you would pay, and I'm going to handle all of the litigation that you have at that price, a fixed price, not an hourly rate. Mm-hmm. I'll do it. And the only one thing that I ask is that there's going to be an uncle clause for both of us. He said, what's the uncle clause? I said, if what happens is that all of a sudden you've given me too much and I need more lawyers or I need more assistants, I need more paralegals, I'm going to come to you and I'm going to say, hey, I can't do it the way that it's presently structured. We'll either increase the retainer agreement or what happens is that we'll go our separate way. And I mm-hmm. said, on the other hand, if you ever think that you're paying me and you're not getting value for it, you just call me and I'll either lower the rate or what we'll do is we'll go our separate ways. And he said, do you want to write that up? And I said, no, mm-hmm. I want us to shake hands on it and I want us to live that way. And we lived that way for 20 years.
Wow.
In a relationship. But that's, again, indicative of the industry at its best, is that you can do those kinds of things. And it was a story that other people, the person who was engaged with it, said it was the most important thing I ever did because he said, I'd get involved in litigation and you'd be handling the case, Mike, and I'd go in, and someone would sit down with me and he'd say, we can pay millions of dollars to lawyers, or we can try to settle this case. And I'd look at them and I'd say, doesn't bother me. I've got a fixed cost. And he said people would come around and they'd start. Wow. He said it was a huge advantage.
Yeah. Mosniak, what do you
think? You know, the interesting thing about that, Dave, was I have never heard of any other firm, and I really haven't, that would just say, we'll do all your litigation for a fixed monthly fee. You pay us. I don't care if you're sued 20 times or zero, you're going to pay this amount of money every month. And then I took that model that Mike did, and I went to, at least three or four other companies that I wasn't doing litigation with. And I said, we will handle all of your work, and I'll become your outside GC, if you will. Mm-hmm. And we'll do your regulatory, we'll do your whatever for, and you pay us blank dollars a month. And ultimately, that was very successful for them and very successful for us, because then you didn't have conflicts. You just knew you were going to do all that work and you got a fixed fee every month.
Well,
and that was early on. And that was something
that's a model that all the attorneys are like trying to figure out, but they can't quite get there. And so people still want to know what's your hourly rate and blah, blah, blah. Right. So, but in your case, that's cool because you also don't have to deal with all that administrative junk. So
that's right.
That's kind of streamlined. Hey, I got to ask you guys.
Let me add one other thing.
You'd interrupt me at some point.
I did.
And here
did.
You are.
Well,
yeah.
This is an important point, which is it gave us an incentive to resolve things as quickly as possible. So we never would say, hey, let's do some more depositions.
But if you're paid by the hour,
that's the way that you do it.
Interesting. All right.
I mean, just think of a client right now that says, look, I don't care. How much is this going to cost? And you say, well, I don't know, but the longer it takes me, the more it's going to cost you. Yep. I mean, what a horrible situation that hourly rate is. It's terrible.
Oh.
Anyway.
Well, but things are changing very slowly from my observation in the legal field. But I want to ask you guys how you're engaged in the firm today, because I picture both of you sort of like having an office on the upper floor of the building, and young lawyers have to climb like 1,000 steps to ask you a question about mineral rights or something. You're sitting, like, how do you engage now?
You go ahead, Mike.
Exactly how it works?
Yeah.
Well, when we were both, I had had some medical issues, and so that's I had to tell the firm, look, I need to step back some. And Mike and I sat down and said, do we want to have a legacy firm that will carry on after us? Or do we had opportunities to, and it sounds strange, but sell the firm, merge with a bigger firm, get a contract for the two of us, frankly, and ride off into the sunset. And we said, no, let's sort of give it to all of the young people, because we never really charged them. We just took our capital account out and just became advisors. And frankly, they took our offices and made one little office that we share, which is really disappointing because it's got all of Beatty's memorabilia in it. And so that's been a problem. So when I go in there, I feel sort of emasculated, you know? It's really bad.
Well,
it's a great joke, other than the fact that I was at the firm today, and we don't have that little office anymore.
they've gotten rid of that now?
It was a contractual provision that what happened is that we would have offices, we would have secretarial help, we would have those things. They're wonderful to us. They really are great. But because I'm in now with my grandchildren in Connecticut, Mike's in Scottsdale, it doesn't make sense to keep that office.
So what would you guys, shift gears again, I have to shift gears, are we?
Yeah.
Going. What advice would you give now to your founding partner selves?
One, everything is built on trust and credibility. We've already talked about that. That is a critically important thing. Secondly, the decision to all of a sudden have a high specialty rate is I think also critical. Because it engenders trust if you have that as well. The other thing is recognize where your client is. I said, you know, it never helped us to all of a sudden sponsor something at the symphony level, because most of the guys who were energy executives were listening to country music. So, you know, you have to know who your audience is and work with that. Those are some of the things that I think are critical. Another one of the things that I think are important is that you need to all of a sudden understand that decision-making needs to be centralized. You can't just, I think that the partnership is really a miserable way to do business where you kind of, everybody comes in the room and we talk about whether we're going to hire this secretary or a receptionist or how much money we're going to spend on candy. Let's get past that. And what happens is the key to that is being successful and letting everyone know we're all going to make a lot of money, but what we have is in the end, Mike and Mike have got to be able to make a decision as to whether we open a new office or whether we don't.
Cool. Mike Wozniak.
Yeah, a couple things. First of all, you've really got to be passionate about what you do. You can't halfway do it. And if I look back right now, today, at our ages, if I can count my best 20 friends, they've all been clients. I have always believed that you have to care deeply, so deeply about your clients that they really become your best friends. I have no friends, really, if you think about it that way, that somehow weren't involved in the energy business. And so, and part of that was because I honestly believe that when a client had a problem, it's my problem. It's not, I don't go home from the office at 6 o'clock and say, forget it. And all the people that say, oh, lawyers are under such stress because they take all these problems and they internalize them. Yes, that's right. And that makes you a better lawyer because you really deeply care. And I knew everybody's spouses and what they did for their fun. And I think that's part of what it is to be a real advocate for your people. And that's so important.
Wow. Yeah.
I apologize for remote Mike, but he misspoke. When he said that his 20 best friends were clients, he meant to say my 20 best friends are my partner and my clients.
Oh, you know, I caught that and I thought, wow, okay, I'm not going to jump in on that, but you certainly
well,
can.
Well, that was so obvious.
Yes, of course. All right, guys, I'm going to switch this to something I'm calling the lightning round. And this is because there's a lot of fun stuff to talk about and we don't have a lot of time left. Right. But it seems that the best partnerships have sort of a yin and a yang aspect where the partners complement each other's strengths and, you know, that sort of thing. But I want to ask you guys about a few of them. So you're going to let me do that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here we go.
Sure.
Which of you is the optimist and which is the realist?
I'm the optimist and he's the realist.
Yep.
You agree?
That's right.
All right. Okay, yep. Next. Which of you was more focused on getting business and which one wanted to do the work?
Neither one of us wanted to do the work. We both wanted to get the business.
Yeah, we both love to bring in business.
That's funny. All right. Which is the good cop? Which is the bad cop?
Oh, I'm definitely the bad cop.
Absolutely, yeah? He is. Absolutely. I love to be loved.
Yeah, Mike would always tell me you have to, like when someone was having a problem, oh, just give them some, just tell them they're good and give them some love. I'd say, give me a break.
So did you have to act like the bad cop sometimes?
It came natural to me.
That's great. All right, which one of you is better looking and which one's smarter?
The number of times, honestly, the number of times while he was single, that I had women call me and say, could you set me up with Mike Wozniak? I mean, if I had a dollar, it would make me a rich man. And it's incredible. They would talk about, and it was pathetic, his incredible blue eyes. He's got the greatest blue eyes in the whole world. And I would say, you don't want to do this. You don't want to do this, but... They didn't listen.
So with all of this,
I have nothing to say to that except that my spouse had passed away. I had three daughters at home, and I didn't have time for any of that. And I unfortunately, if it was today, things would be different.
So Mike Wozniak, does that by default then make your partner the smarter one?
I think so. And the only part I'll say about that, about being smarter, is we used to have a joke. Is that we could make all firm decisions, and we always agreed at the urinal because we could both stand there and get it done, you know? It was easy.
Well, quick decisions, I hope. Yeah, so before Beatty and Wozniak, Michael Beatty, you were chief of staff, you mentioned, for Governor Romer. Michael Wozniak, you served as three-term mayor of Cherry Hills Village. So were those jobs harder than running a law firm?
You know, the difficult part for me on my mind was, and it was during while I was at the law firm, but I had to realize how slow government moves and why it's so important to the process to form a task force, to determine the right course of action, to have three readings of every ordinance. So I learned a lot about that, but also it was a very satisfying job for me. And 80% of it was wonderful. 20% of it was, as you say, very, very difficult. And it's hard to please all your constituents. And you just have to realize you can't. You've got to do what's right and what you feel is right.
For the lightning round, I'll just quickly say that when it's the reason that you see people who have been in business be unsuccessful in government, and that is you have to build consensus. You can't make the decision and say, this is what we're going to do. It helped me as a trial lawyer because I recognized that I had to persuade people. And so it helped me with the jury, because I knew that I had to get all those people to agree with me in the end. So I worked very hard. That's why I loved being the good cop. That's why I was always there to give people a hug. It was an important part of the process, and I think it makes you better.
What about when you were chief of staff for Governor Romer? I mean, that was before you had your own law firm. Anything you brought to that? Was that harder, difficult?
It was much more difficult. It was much more difficult. And first of all, you'd have to adjust to the fact that you weren't going to get paid very much. It genuinely was a sense of public service. But I think that Mike and I both have that, and so I didn't really worry about
it. Yeah. All right. Last question. You both have grandchildren, and I don't have them yet, but we're looking down the road at it. And wisdom, to me, is like a funny thing because, like, I want to impart my wisdom on my kids, and I can't wait to impart my wisdom on my grandchildren. And yet, you know, they may not be open to that. They may not want that. So if there's one thing, one highly relevant thing that you want your grandkids to know from your perspective, what is that?
Character matters. For me, that's a very easy thing to say. And people all of a sudden want to bring us back to the America of old, and they talk about all sorts of things, but they leave out the one thing that really does reflect the America of old, and that is the importance of character, the importance of honesty. And I think that what we really need to do is we need to all recognize that a handshake means something, that what happens is that an oath means something, that what happens is that these things matter. And if we don't have those, we really have lost. It's a learned hand comment. If the Constitution lives within people's hearts, you don't need to write it down. And if it doesn't live within their hearts, no amount of pen and ink is ever going to save this country.
Well, do your kids, do your children, do your grandchildren, I mean, that sounds, in today's world of social media and all the stuff that we see, sounds old-fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you bring that to life for them so that it feels relevant?
You tell stories about knighthood and the things that all of a sudden that the Knights of the Round Table stood for and how that important. And so they love to have the guy on a horse in shining armor. So what you do is you connect those things with character. That's the way that I've found that it gets across to them.
Thank you. Michael Wozniak, how would you answer that question?
Well, that's a very difficult one. I tried to tell my kids that this is sort of corny, but every night before I go to bed, I ask myself if I was kind to anybody today. And if I wasn't kind to somebody, then I say to myself, boy, I better be kind to two people tomorrow. And I think that sort of idea of respecting everyone and realizing that everyone has had difficulties in their lives, and you just need to realize that sometimes people have a bad day and you've got to respect them and it's corny, but treat them the way you want to be treated. You know, and it's hard though, because as you're right, if you've got my oldest grandchild is just going to turn 13, with social media and everything else, does any of that get through to them? All you can do is hope and try.
What haven't we talked about, guys? How should we wrap up?
Well, my only issue is I want to tell you that the joy of my life was working with Mike Beatty, because not only was he the smartest litigator I've ever seen, he also had this ability to take the most complicated scenario and dumb it down so that a juror could understand it. And he also had theatrical thing, and I'll tell that one story. It was in front of the federal judge in Wyoming, and there were like 54 defendants, and this plaintiff said he had all this evidence. And so Beatty got the clerk to let him into the courtroom the night before, and he put 54 boxes, stacked them up there. And the judge said, he stood up and said, "Mr. Beatty, what is all this?" And I'm going to shorten this. And he said, "Well, Your Honor, there's 54 defendants." And the plaintiff says he's got evidence, 54 boxes of evidence. "So let me show you that, Your Honor." And he took the first box and he opened it, and it was empty. He took the second box, he opened it, and it was empty. And he said, "This is how much evidence the plaintiff has." And he went for the third box. And finally, the federal judge said, "That's enough, Mr. Beatty. I get the issue." Now, there's not too many people that can pull that off. And that's why I respect and love Mike so much, because he could do things like that that were unbelievable, frankly.
You got to have fun, you know? And that was one of the great things about being Mike's partner, is that we were able to laugh every single day. We had something that we enjoyed, and we were doing something we both loved.
Wow. Well, guys, that's a good note to end on, and I'm going to do that. I'm glad you've joined us for this special look at the lives and legacy of Mike Beatty and Mike Wozniak. It is rare to find a partnership that spans three decades, and even rarer to find one built on such deep-seated passion. And I was going to say some other things that I've written, but you guys like each other, and that's awesome. That's so awesome. Their journey from a two-man startup to a national powerhouse is a true Colorado success story. If you've enjoyed this conversation, be sure to subscribe to the ProCo 360 podcast for more stories from leaders and entrepreneurs who are making an impact in our state. I'm Dave Tabor, and I'll see you next time